This session this morning is adapted from a talk I've heard a couple of times given by Dr. Ron Cranford at Hennepin County Medical Center, who is a neurologist. He chairs the Biomedical Ethics Committee at the University of Minnesota. He has testified at Senate hearings on those kinds of issues and is on a couple of panels, both nationally appointed and state appointed, who are drawing up guidelines for medical ethical issues as far as treatment, when treatment can be stopped, defining brain death, and that sort of thing. So this is really his talk, and since he's not here, I'll try to give it. I guess the Christian perspective I would like to try to get from you all, I hope we have some time for discussion. I'll try to get some in. There's a fair amount of material, and this is more of an ethical talk rather than a specifically Christian talk, I guess. Okay? Sergeant David Mack is a, or I should say, was at the time in January of 1980, a sergeant in the Minneapolis Police Force. He's a big, strapping, probably 6'3", 215-pound man with a lovely family. He had an attractive wife and a couple of kids. His wife proved through the following years to be a courageous and intelligent woman, and really went through quite an experience in the next couple of years very well. So let me just start out by writing that date up to sort of keep us in mind of where things are happening here. So in January of 1980, Sergeant Mack, along with two other police officers, served a search warrant on a home in Minneapolis, and a man named, I believe his name was Riley Housley III, was in that home at the time. They banged on the doors and announced who they were, and according to Mr. Housley, he said that he did not hear the knockings. They entered the home, and Mr. Housley shot Sergeant Mack twice. Once, I believe. Now, I'll have to say, first of all, that there are a lot of details that I'm not absolutely certain of, because it's all taken from my memory of talks I've heard some time ago. But I think that the gist of the story is real accurate, and there might be some small details that are a little bit off. But I believe he was shot once through the neck, and the bullet went through the neck without hitting any vital structures, not going to the spinal cord or cause major damage that way. And another shot that entered his shoulder, and again was not life-threatening in and of itself. However, it was determined later that the course of events probably was that he, due to the trauma and the event, he vomited. He aspirated the vomitus into his airways, and at that point then was not able to breathe properly, suffered some anoxic damage, in other words, not having enough oxygen, went into a respiratory arrest and a full cardiopulmonary arrest, which is a stoppage of breathing and of your heart function. Paramedics were called immediately. By radio, it was probably 10 minutes or so before they arrived. And so Sergeant Mack is now laying on the floor. He has not been breathing for some time, and I don't think the time is exactly known, but say about 10 minutes. And I guess this is the first point that you say is sort of a decision point in your own mind. I'm going to try to stop and say, think in your own mind, what would you do when you come up on this situation if you're a paramedic? And I think this situation is pretty obvious. Sergeant Mack is laying there, and you're going to want to do everything you possibly can to try to preserve or bring back his life or whatever. He's just laying there, not breathing. So I guess the obvious decision that was made and that we would all make would be to start CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, where you compress the chest and breathe for him. And every effort was made to give him proper medical treatment, and he was brought in the emergency room, and in the same type of activity went on. But I guess the reason why I said that as a decision point is just to use this case as a spin-off to define some other terms. Number one is what, at least in Minnesota, we usually call DNR, and that means do not resuscitate. And that would be a situation where you'd come upon someone and you would not start CPR, although you find them not breathing, in essentially the same situation of cardiopulmonary arrest. The situations where this is used are, first of all, it is an order written by a physician on a patient's chart. It's almost always used in the only in a situation where a patient is either hospitalized or in another care facility, some kind of, old folks home. You're not supposed to use that anymore. But that sort of situation with a care facility. And I guess to try to describe to you the situations where it's used, very old and debilitated patients are sometimes deemed to be better for them not to be resuscitated and go through the full range of medical activity that happens when someone arrests. Some people in comas, some people in very severe end-stage heart failure, end-stage chronic lung disease, emphysema, and bronchitis, where people have been hospitalized repeatedly and repeatedly, and finally they've come to the end of the line. Their hearts or their lungs just isn't going to do the job anymore. And at that point, at some point, oftentimes a do not resuscitate order is written. In my experience, and it's admittedly limited, however, I have heard other physicians who are much more experienced talk about it to some extent. DNR orders are not given lightly. They are always, I would say, almost always done after consultation, either with the patient, if the patient is confident and able to talk about what he would like to have done. Another situation where that would come up more often would be in a terminally ill patient with, say, cancer, where the person knows that he or she doesn't have, has very little time left. They might be in a tremendous amount of pain or discomfort, and they would wish on their own to not be resuscitated if their heart stopped. Or when the patient is not competent to make that kind of decision, such as coma or other situations, then the family is consulted. And I think that's pretty universally true. I think occasionally that the DNR or can, and I'm sure has been, abused, maybe for people who are mentally ill or other situations like that. But I would say generally it's only done after a pretty thorough consultation with the family. There is a diversion of opinions, however, as to whether the physician should make the decision or whether the family should actually make the decision. And the first line of thought is that it's purely the family's decision, and I think you can understand that feeling, that the family ought, family or and or patient, if the patient's confident, should make the decision whether they want to be resuscitated. Some physicians, however, believe that that is too heavy a weight of responsibility to say that your husband or your father or mother or your wife should not be resuscitated, and they feel that they need to take the weight of that responsibility away from the family, that the family needs to be consulted and talked to, gotten a flavor of their feelings on it, but sort of to give the family permission to do it, to sort of take the weight of the responsibility if they are agreeable. And it's a fine line, and it's a difficult distinction to make sometimes what you're doing. But I think the do not resuscitate order is an important one. It's something that we all need to be familiar with, so when we come to that situation, we'll know what people are talking to. And maybe to clarify a bit more, do not resuscitate means just that. It doesn't mean anything more. It means that if you're found in a cardiopulmonary arrest, that they will not start CPR, you will not be resuscitated, they will not put you on a ventilator. It does not mean that you won't be treated for other things. If, for instance, you went into you had an allergic reaction to some kind of a food and you could actually die from that, or to a bee sting or any number of things, it does not mean that you wouldn't be treated medically for that with adrenaline and the proper medications. Or if you suffer a severe infection, pneumonia, that would be treated under the DNR order. So it's a full go for everything except for cardiopulmonary arrest. And do not treat orders are different, and I'll get into that a little bit later. So Sergeant Mack, again, that was January 1980 when this happened. He came into the hospital and was treated very aggressively. He was in bad shape. He had a number of complications. He was taken to the surgery and explored, stabilized, taken to the intensive care unit, and he was on a ventilator all the time after he came into the hospital. And basically was stabilized, and I don't know a lot of the details about what the complications were, but there he was, and he was not responsive, and it was difficult to know exactly what was going to happen. And in a situation like that, especially with a young person, at first you have no way of predicting an outcome, because you don't know precisely how long the brain has been without oxygen, and there really is no way at that time to predict. So I'll write the next spot on timeline here. And that's 4 to 6 weeks later. And within 4 to 6 weeks, physicians and neurologists are able to make a better prediction about how someone is going to do. I said 4 to 6 weeks because I'm not precisely sure, but I think that's about the right time that it was done. At this time, the diagnosis of anoxic encephalopathy was firmly made, which means just an insult to the brain for lack of oxygen for a length of time. His prognosis was judged to be very poor. All along, the family had been very much in touch with the situation and been talking with the doctors and were aware of his prognosis. But I guess this is another decision point now, Sergeant Mack, and I want you in your minds to think about, what would you do? He's a young man, and he's been on a ventilator now. He's not making any kind of interactions with his environment at all. He doesn't respond to his family, doesn't respond to anyone. He doesn't know that you're in and out of the room. He is solely dependent, to all appearances, on his ventilator. It was discussed heavily with the family, and as it would happen, Sergeant Mack had served in Vietnam and had run across situations like this in the past. In particular, he had had a friend who was severely injured and became, I can't remember, it was paraplegic or quadriplegic, but also was in a coma for some time and was severely injured. And he had made his feelings very well known to both fellow police officers and to his family that if he was ever in a similar situation, that he would not want to live, that he would not want extraordinary measures taken, but rather to let him die with some dignity. And apparently these were made quite clearly known to his family and to his, like I said, his police officer friends, who both came in and talked with the neurologists and with various people about these considerations. The neurologists at this point then decided, in consultation with the family and his friends, with that in mind, that they felt that the ventilator ought to be turned off. They made that decision and of what they felt ought to be done. And then they went to a biomedical ethics committee that was formed at the hospital. The committee consisted of 12 people that represented a broad range of people within the hospital, from medical staff on neurology and psychiatry, psychologists, as well as medicine, and the nursing staff was represented, administration was represented, and I think there were a couple members of the lay community involved. And basically, they went through. I believe there was a clergy member. I think one of the members is a clergy member from the hospital. And feel free to ask questions. Anytime I say something that's unclear or that you want to especially talk about, I'd be glad to stop. They discussed the case and the situation, and they had been aware of other similar situations, such as the Karen Quinlivan case and other medical legal precedents, and they felt that a legal order was not necessary, that this case was clear-cut enough, that they gave a unanimous opinion that this was a proper course of action. They did not write orders or say this needs to be done or should be done. It was the decision and the orders were written by the physicians in charge of the case, which were the chief of neurology, Dr. Cranford, and the chief of medicine. So that indeed was the decision that they came up with, was to turn off the ventilator. And now we get into the do not treat concept. Before we talked about do not resuscitate, now I'm going to talk a little bit about do not treat and what that means. So I'll go to the board. Clear-cut case, because all it means is one simple thing. If someone has arrested, you don't start CPR. But do not treat crosses a broad range of what medicine can or cannot do for someone. And so a do not treat order is not a simple thing. The way it's done properly, at least in Hennepin County Medical Center, is to write the order, do not treat, and specify exactly what you mean by that. What you want done for the patient, what you do not want done for the patient. And taking off a ventilator falls within that concept. And the first group is what I'll call extraordinary measures. And this is, the best example of this is the ventilator. And I think probably most of us are a little bit familiar with that concept, that people feel that there are times when a ventilator is no longer a proper mode of treatment. Dialysis is sort of in between. As when I was thinking about it, it's kind of a tough one, but that is another one that's probably in that category. There's another category that I'd call routine medical care. And under routine medical care, I think the best example is antibiotics. I hope you can read the things that I write. But there are other things besides just antibiotics. There's a whole range of things. Like I mentioned before, you'd treat someone who had an allergic reaction. There are many severe immunological diseases that people can be saved by steroids. Let's see. Dialysis, well, is somewhere in between those two. Some people think that that's more routine, and some people think that's extraordinary. But those are the first two categories. And at this time, Sergeant Mack was taken off the ventilator, but he was full go otherwise. So he was going to be treated with antibiotics for any infections and all that sort of thing. Let me go on. The third category, the way I'm writing them up, is nutrition and water.
H2O.
This is also part of the treatment for many patients, and in extraordinary situations, sometimes even food and water have been withheld from patients. I know it, at Hennepin County Medical Center, there was a case of someone who was pretty clearly brain dead that they decided would be better served by not keeping the body functioning any longer, and they actually withheld food and water. That's very extraordinary and not done lightly, or not done very often. And the fourth category are what, at least in a proper usage of do not treat, these are measures that are always given to every patient. And they are measures that preserve dignity, hygiene, and pain and discomfort, control of pain and discomfort. And that's the fourth category. And so when you give an order to do not treat, those are the things that go through your mind. Are you just stopping, taking off a ventilator? Are you stopping routine medical care? Are you stopping nutrition and sustenance? Three things are all within your range of possible, but one thing that every patient should be given, as long as they are, even if it's just their body is around, is to be treated in such a way that it maintains their dignity and their hygiene, and their pain is controlled. And so I guess there could be one more category, and that would be a category of, is there ever a situation where you'd actually actively intervene in trying to shorten a person's life? In other words, euthanasia. And that's something that I think is universally not accepted at this time in the medical community in any situation, whether a person having cancer and a tremendous amount of pain and you can't relieve it. It's just not accepted at this time to give someone a shot and let them die. It's just not believed to be acceptable. I think it's something, though, that we could think about of whether sometimes that would be appropriate. I think the closest situation to this that I know of that has been done, patients with Lou Gehrig's disease, for instance, where the patient remains conscious, but they slowly lose control of bodily muscles, motor control, and when that reaches the end stage, many times the patient, usually what the patients die of, are they're not able to breathe any longer, their respiratory muscles fail. So if that situation arises, usually there is there ought to be a do not resuscitate order given for that person, because they can live for months, years, many years on a respirator, being conscious but being totally unable to communicate or move any of their muscles in the end stage. And so that's a place where the DNR order is very appropriate and ought to be given. But if by some chance a person like that ends up on a respirator, sometimes it's necessary to remove that ventilator, even though you know it's going to cause their death. And the problem arises that that's a terrifying way to die. It probably won't last forever, but to feel like you're suffocating and that sort of thing is very terrifying. And in that situation, I have heard of them giving barbiturates to the patient to slip the patient into a coma and then removing a respirator. The reason that makes it almost an active intervention on terminating their life is that barbiturates also decrease any respiratory drive that the person already has. So you are, in effect, putting them into a coma, decreasing the respiratory drive, and taking them off a ventilator. So there's some fine lines that can be drawn, and those are things that we can think about. Yes? No, go right ahead. So a tide, a gamma counter, so it's a radiation type technique, a nuclear study. Anyhow. Wait.
It is. It's the best thing that we have at this time. let's see. So that's how we define brain death, and that is relatively clear cut, even though it is a phase in our test. We believe that anyway, that it's a pretty good test. The persistent vegetative state, on the other hand, sometimes very difficult to define. When is someone laying in a coma and able to reversible state versus an irreversible state, in other words? When is he not interacting with his environment that he will at some point be able to do that? I guess what in the past, what we've said is that after a period of months, 2 months, 3 months, the probability that someone will come out of a vegetative state and recover cerebral hemisphere function for thought, have a meaningful life, or extremely remote. And in fact, there had been only one exception to this known in the literature that was well documented beyond a couple of months. So, at about 6 to 8 months out, I was in the summer of 1980, President Mack had been in the hospital. I had been getting full treatment up until that time, and I finally decided, again with full consultation with the family, that they would go to a further stage of do not treat, and that is do not use routine medical care. So they decided to not only not use extraordinary measures, but also not do these sorts of things. So he had been surviving quite well off the ventilator, and they decided to put him under the status of do not treat and come to any guys and that sort of thing. We felt that without any guys support, that it seemed he would actually develop a pneumonia and die. And of course it doesn't always happen, but they thought sooner or later it would. And at that time, was removed from the hospital. That's when fluids are in the throat and the esophagus or the mouth and go down the air passages. So you get contamination in the air passages in the lungs from either the stomach or the mouth or the throat contact. And then an infection ensues very often. And the fact that this is probably what we're doing now. So he was moved to a nursing home. And in fact, in this case, it's sort of difficult to find one that was willing to take him. Whereas in the same similar case, no one wants to take on a sensational case where you might have people coming in and causing a lot of trouble and legal ramifications and a tremendous job to take care of someone like that. So they look around and they find a good place that's willing to do it. And they send them there under this guy to do not treat other than because of his dignity, hygiene, and comfort. And nutrition and water. Fuzzy Mac was not able to swallow food, but he was fed to nasal gastric tube. That is a tube that goes down your nose, your esophagus, and your stomach, and he got his nutrition and water through that method. And they decided to continue that because they decided it was too, they didn't feel that in good conscience they could remove that from him, the nutrition and water support. So that was the status he was on. And I guess this is another point that I wanted to say for you to think in your mind of, is that a proper course? What would you have done? Or is it more proper to maybe even remove food and water since he couldn't eat it in terms of himself? He could make some loss. And so it seems some reasonable decision in that way. But in any case, that was the decision that they made. Let's see if I'm missing one somehow. What they did do for him was they hired a private duty nurse that was there 24 hours a day. He had a 24-hour private duty nurse, and he had extensive CT, physical therapy. He was trained regularly to prevent blood sores. He was extensive exercise to prevent contrastation from developing. Did regular visits by a physician, he was given only convulsions. I was one of the few medications that he was given because he was prone to develop convulsions, and they felt that as a part of preserving his dignity and maybe comfort, not so much of him but of his family, he was visiting him regularly, but it would only be the more ethical thing to do to give him only convulsions. So he was basically that he was informed as well as to continue good hygiene, cleaning and washing and brushing teeth and all that sort of thing.